In 1968, a strange sight turned up on the carnival and fair circuit. A man named Frank Hansen toured with a special trailer containing a block of ice, within which appeared to be a 6-foot-tall hairy humanoid. This exhibit might have disappeared into the dustbin of history had it not been for the work of cryptozoologists Ivan Sanderson and Bernard Heuvelmans, who both wrote scholarly articles purporting the creature to be a real animal or perhaps humanoid. With this endorsement, the question of whether this exhibit, now known as the Minnesota Iceman, was a real creature or just a carnival hoax, became a part of cryptozoological debates for decades.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Today on Monster Talk, we'll speak with former sideshow performer and Bigfoot researcher Matt Crowley. You may recall us mentioning Matt's research in our previous episode about Jimmy Chilcutt and his work on dermal ridges. This interview runs a little longer than most, so we'll get into it very quickly. But first, a little
Monster Talk.
Today we're going to talk with Matt Crowley. I always want to call him Matt the Tube, because he used to work with the Jim Rose Circus, and I guess he could talk to us about that, but he specialized in making something really disgusting called bile beer. And yeah, well, I'm sure he'll...
We should also just sort of, we should make sure that we mention his work on the dermatoglyphics as well.
That's right. We've actually talked about his work before in our episode where we talked about dermatoglyphics. And specifically where we interviewed Jimmy Chilcutt.
And we learned how to pronounce the word.
That's right. And we also learned that Matt had done a very thorough job of explaining how artifacts of the casting process can produce something that looks very much like dermal ridges. I think he did a very good job, and that's all on his website, which is called Orgone Research. We'll put the link in the show notes. Scooby-Doo, in their first season, did an episode where the gang tries to investigate a case where there's an Iceman. He's basically a caveman in a block of ice. And
was it the original series?
Yeah, the original series, which was really pretty much contemporaneous with the Iceman case. It would have been just a little bit after.
Interesting.
Yeah. So,
what did they conclude?
Well, it turned out that it was a guy in a costume.
What do those meddling kids?
Yeah, it was a good episode. Because at one point, I believe Scooby's wearing the costume of the cave.
Oh, yeah. That wacky canine.
Yeah. The original Skeptic cartoon. They always dug in, you know.
And what, are there others?
SpongeBob SquarePants is fairly...
Maybe some South Park. Yeah.
I guess South Park is actually pretty skeptical.
And Lisa from The Simpsons.
Oh, Lisa from The Simpsons, absolutely. But yeah, I was going to say the South Park episode on Cold Reading.
John Edward
was very good. So I will... until Scrappy-Doo showed up. Everything was fine. So,
did you say Scrappy Douche?
I should have.
I believe you did.
Yeah, he. Don't get me started.
Monster Talk.
So today we're going to talk to you about the Minnesota Iceman.
I can dig it.
Before we do, do you want to give us?
No one else.
Do you want to give us a little background on the Minnesota Iceman and how you found out about it and got interested in it?
When I was a kid, my mother was very interested in anomalies and curiosities, fringe science, if you will. Back in the late '60s, there were magazines like Fate, of course, and also men's magazines like Saga and Argosy. And she actually had a stack of Argosy and Saga magazines that I would look through as a kid. I was too young to sort of go for the cheesecake, but I would see these articles on things like you know, Bigfoot or UFOs or a lot of adventure type stuff. But that's why she had these magazines. And so I remembered encountering the Minnesota Iceman story as a child, and I would have been about maybe 9 or 10. And I also became interested in Bigfoot when I was about 9 or 10. I saw a movie with my mother and my brother about Bigfoot. And then I was given John Green's On the Track of the Sasquatch when I was 9. So I was very interested in Bigfoot as a child, and watched these TV shows on the subject in the early 70s. Was very interested, and you couldn't really get any other information on the subject besides the occasional TV show or these. I had all three of John Green's early books, and then by the time I got to high school in 76, I got kind of angry that Bigfoot hadn't been discovered, and I really put the subject aside until about the year 2000, and I saw a story on the internet regarding the Skookum cast. I thought, wow, that's pretty interesting. And it finally dawned on me that there was all this information about Bigfoot in general on the internet. And in about 2003, I saw a presentation that Lauren Coleman gave here in Seattle, put on by the Seattle Museum of the Mysteries. And I was listening to his presentation, and he started talking about things like, oh, well, the history of the Yeti and the Shipton tracks. I thought, oh, yeah, that's pretty interesting. I kind of remember that. And then he talked about the tracks found in Northern California in 58. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I kind of remember that. And, you know, of course, he talked about the Patterson film. And then he started talking about the Minnesota Iceman, and I thought, oh, my God. And my reaction to that was based on the fact that I'd been a sideshow performer from 1991 until 1994. And so in the meantime, even though I had totally forgotten about the Minnesota Iceman, I'd had this sideshow background, and that totally colored my perception of what the Minnesota Iceman was all about.
Because it seemed more real and authentic now?
No. Oh, no. Yes, that's right. Well, what I'm assuming to do, because I'm on the hot seat, is to illustrate why someone with a sideshow background would be so intrinsically skeptical of an exhibit like the Minnesota Iceman.
Yeah, and let me just throw this out there. It's the spoiler alert. Because this is the same sort of thing that happens with pro wrestling. If you don't want to know the truth, don't listen. Go ahead, Matt.
Plug your ears now.
All right, Matt, let us have it.
Well, first of all, I should explain for those who don't know what I did as a sideshow performer. The history of sideshow was such that by the time I started in 1991, it was in severe decline. It was superseded by television and movies, and as far as traveling carnivals and circuses went, it had been displaced by things like rides quite a bit. So sideshow as an American art form had really declined. I mean, it was basically almost gone by 91, and so I just happened to meet up with a bunch of guys in Seattle who were doing these things on their own, and so by word of mouth, we learned about each other, and we linked up with this gentleman, Jim Rose, who had been busking down in Venice Beach. You know, he'd been doing a lying on a bed of nails and whatnot as a busker, and Jim Rose's great talent was promotion. I would really put him up there with a guy like P.T. Barnum, and I say that in all seriousness. As far as promotion goes, I mean, he really had just absolute genius as far as being able to promote these kind of things. So Jim Rose and the four original performers, myself included, started playing locally here in Seattle, and then we went, we got the Perry Farrell of Lollapalooza fame heard about us, and invited us to come on Lollapalooza. We toured Canada right before the summer of 92, and then we went on Lollapalooza in 92, and then we were on the Sally Jesse Raphael show, and we toured all around the United States, Canada, and Western Europe, and Australia during that short period of time. And so I had a very intense exposure to Sideshow during that time. But see, as far as Sideshow went, what our troupe was, we were what was called working acts, which were individual performers performing stunts. We didn't have any so-called freaks, which would be people that had birth defects. And we had, for a time, we worked with a gal who was short. We went on one Canadian tour with her, Dolly the Doll Lady, but we didn't employ anything like gaffs or pickled punks or any of that nature. We were specifically a working act. So it wasn't until after I got off the Sideshow that I began to learn the history of Sideshow. And I began to realize sort of afterwards what place we had in the history of this enterprise.
And so for our listeners who don't know pickled punks and gaffs, the pickled punks are, and correct me if I'm wrong, those are actual real things, real babies that are born with birth defects and then preserved. And then
some of them are. And it's good that you mentioned the word gaff, because gaff is a very important word. Gaff means a fake, and it can be used, I think the proper word is adjective. If something is gaffed, it means it's been tampered with, so it doesn't function as it originally did. Like a pair of handcuffs can be gaffed so that they can be immediately opened, right? Or in terms of a noun, a gaff is a fake exhibit. And in general, as far as a Sideshow term of gaff, it means a solid three-dimensional artifact that's on display that is a fake of some kind. It is a fabricated illusion of some kind. Now, when you mention pickled punks, there was a time in history when people, showmen, were able to obtain the recently deceased bodies of neonates that didn't survive, and often these were deformed, severely deformed neonates. They were encephalic or severe bone disorders and whatnot, and they were stillborn. And so they were very small, and they would be preserved, I presume, in formaldehyde. And sometimes they would be purchased by these showmen, and they would be exhibited by these showmen. But of course, as time went on and laws began enacted, and some of these showmen decided that, well, it was too legally risky to display genuine human specimens, they resorted to creating gaffs, which were fabricated illusions. And those have a special name, and those were called pickled punks or bouncers.
Well, Matt, I was just going to throw in there that one of the things that makes the Sideshow and the carnival so interesting, and certainly in regard to like things like the Iceman, is that there's this this blending of the real and the gaffed. It's you know, sometimes you'll see something that you know couldn't really, doesn't seem like it could be real, but in fact it is real. It may be, you know, a cow with, you know, an extra leg or something. So then you have things that couldn't be real, and in fact they're not real. So I think that tends to add an authenticity to it.
Yes, you're absolutely right. In fact, if you look at the history of Sideshow, you'll often see things just like that. For instance, even here in Seattle, I saw a small circus a couple of years ago that had a snake exhibit or a reptile exhibit. And those were very common years ago because, of course, out in the boonies, you would never see an exotic tropical snake. And they, of course, before television became common, you'd never see such a thing in your life. And so that was, you know, a display of a wild animal from some exotic place was a mainstay of the sideshows for before the, oh, I don't know, the 1950s or 40s. And they often, you're absolutely right, they would often mix real specimens with fake specimens. There's a local tie-in down in the Pacific Northwest, which I'm very proud of as a member of the as a resident of the Pacific Northwest. Down in Long Beach, Washington, there's a place called Marsh's Free Museum, and it's absolutely chock full, literally to the ceiling, with swag. And it has a great deal of artifacts like that, skulls and mummified animals. And indeed, there is a mixture of real animals and then gaffes, like, say, a two-headed calf. And it's kind of sad because they have a two-headed calf that's beginning to split in half. You know, you can see where it was joined together. Now that's dried and is falling apart. But the real piece de resistance of Marsh's Free Museum is a gaffe called Jake the Alligator Man, and they built a special glass case, and it's a half man, half alligator. It's quite the pride of the Pacific Northwest.
I just wanted to know which half was alligator. Sorry, the front or back?
the rear half is alligator. Okay. Although the tail is somewhat disproportionate as far as an alligator tail goes, if you're a connoisseur, I mean, you can actually become a connoisseur of these things. There's such a small number of artists making these gaffes today that each of these artists who creates them has a certain sort of a style, and you can begin to see patterns in their stylings.
Well, Matt, what's the status of sideshows today, then?
Today, it's almost all working acts. That is to say that it's just performers doing things like swallowing swords or eating fire or walking up a ladder of swords or having concrete blocks smashed on their chest or the human pincushion act. Those are all stunts, and in general, I try to follow these people, say, on Facebook, and there's a whole lot of them out there, but I don't get the impression that many of them are traveling. Some of these older guys, like Ward Hall, I'm not even sure of the status of some of these older acts. They're still on the road or they're traveling. So a lot of it today is younger people, but who don't seem to travel too much. I caught one of my fellow performers, Tim Cridland, was with a group called the Hell's a Poppin' Sideshow. They successfully traveled across the United States. I caught their act in Seattle here, and it was quite good. But it has significantly declined since its heyday of about the 1930s.
So does this mean that gaffes aren't and sideshow things like that are just not popular today, or people don't believe in them anymore?
I'm not sure. I think that first of all, there's not many artists out there making the gaffes, and the weird thing is that since the explosive growth of the internet, a lot of the artists who are making sideshow gaffes are doing things like selling them on eBay to private collectors, and so they don't really get exhibited on sideshows on the road. They're not taken on the road. But it should be noted that for many, many years, gaffes were a staple of sideshow exhibits, and there's a couple reasons for that. One, unlike a human being, you don't have to pay them. Two, unlike a human being, they won't get drunk and blow up firecrackers in their hotel room or something, or become obnoxious. It was a cheap way to flesh out your show if you had a non-living entity.
And one more question. When they're sold on eBay, are they sold as gaffes or as real things?
Oh, and almost always is gaffes. Almost always is gaffes. And it's there's, with all due respect, some of the artists that are out there you may not even be familiar with. There's only a few. There's Mark Frierson, one of the more respected names in the business. There's Doug Higley. Ben might be familiar with Doug Higley because Doug Higley created several Chupacabra gaffes.
I've got one in my office right here, in fact.
Oh, well, very good. Yeah, well, was it by Doug Higley?
It was by Doug, yeah.
Yes. And there's a guy out of Portland who's probably my favorite artist, a guy named William Bivens. He has created some replicas of the Jake the Alligator Man and a couple of other gaffes, and his work is really quite spectacular. I think he's an up-and-coming artist in the world of the rarefied world of gaff making. He produced a lamp created out of a human vertebral column, and he used a lampshade that looked like human skin. It wasn't real human skin. I think it was latex, but it was a superbly produced exhibit, and it appeared in Bizarre magazine, and that was sold privately. He works mostly in latex. Some of these guys work with genuine animal tissues, and some of them work only with synthetics. I think Higley only works with synthetics.
Yeah, he's got the one that I've got is it's fascinating. It's created with wire, and then he sort of builds around it, and he's got resins and stuff, and then he paints it. It's pretty cool, but. So I'm seeing how the gaffes obviously are an integral part of a lot of the sideshows, because as you said, you don't have to feed them, they don't cause trouble, they don't demand raises,
right?
But if you would put the Minnesota Iceman in context of the sideshow tradition.
Oh, that's a wonderful thing, because to me, it's one of the greatest of all time. I mean, in my opinion, it's up there with the Cardiff Giant, if not even superior to the Cardiff Giant, for a couple of reasons, okay? And the first thing that should be noted is that the Minnesota Iceman actually appeared on the scene before Patterson's film. As far as I've been able to determine, Frank Hansen, who was the showman exhibiting the Minnesota Iceman, first had it appear in public in May or the spring of 1967. If you recall, Roger Patterson's film of an alleged Sasquatch wasn't until October of 67. By the late 60s, there was still a great deal of interest in the Abominable Snowman and Bigfoot. And so, in my opinion, Hansen was capitalizing on the interest of the Abominable Snowman and got extraordinarily lucky, because Patterson came along just after his exhibit went on the road. And so there's this natural tie-in between the interest in Bigfoot generated by Patterson and the interest in the Minnesota Iceman. And Hansen also got extremely lucky, because his exhibit was discovered by a guy named Terry Cullen. And Terry Cullen advised two genuine scientists, I believe they're both zoologists, Ivan Sanderson and Bernard Heuvelmans, who were also considered cryptozoologists. And he advised these guys, oh, well, there's this exhibit. And see, Cullen took it seriously that, well, this isn't a sideshow exhibit. This is a real animal, okay? And so the plot thickens in 1968, because Sanderson and Heuvelmans travel to Frank Hansen's residence, which was Rolling Stone, Minnesota, in December of, I believe, 68, and physically examine the exhibit. Now, Hansen would not let the exhibit be thawed out. The exhibit was of a 6-foot-long, approximate hominoidal or hairy ape man-type exhibit in a huge block of ice inside of a specially constructed refrigerator. That was lying flat, and it was covered by a thick pane of glass, so you could look down into it. But not only was it, well, not only was there glass covering it, but the specimen was covered by several inches of ice. So Sanderson and Heuvelmans spend a whole bunch of time examining this thing, basically looking at it and photographing it and making anatomical drawings as best as they could, looking through inches of ice. And amazingly enough, they both come out and say, oh, this thing is real. This is a real animal. And furthermore, they even, both of them, Sanderson and Heuvelmans, each published essays in which they declared publicly and with their own scientific backing on the line that these are real animals. In fact, Heuvelmans even gave it a Linnaean nomenclature. He called it Homo pongoides.
What were they thinking? I mean, surely they must have recognized that. I mean, were they really incapable of recognizing that a gap? I mean, from your understanding, what the hell were they thinking?
That's one of the $64 questions. And if you want a slightly deeper answer, in my opinion, what you have is sort of a clash of cultures. And in my opinion, what's really going on is that by the late 1960s, sideshow had been in decline, so that it was becoming more and more esoteric. And when you get two individuals like Sanderson and Heuvelmans who are unfamiliar with the history and tradition of sideshow, they don't take this exhibit in its context. And here's the great tip-off for me. Okay, everybody talks about the, quote, the Minnesota Iceman. Well, the fact is that when Hansen first started exhibiting this exhibit, he called it the Cyberskoy creature. Well, that's your great tip-off right there. There is no place called Cyberskoy, right? It's kind of like if I had started telling you a joke saying a man and a horse walk into a bar, right? That's a tip-off that I'm telling you a joke, right? So when Frank Hansen dubs this exhibit the Cyberskoy creature, and there is no place called Cyberskoy.
Isn't next to Narnia and I think Narnia and where Gulliver traveled. Where was that?
He went to a lot of places.
Well, he went to Brobdingnag.
There you
Lilliput.
Go.
Lilliput. Yeah.
Lilliput.
Lilliput. It's in between those two. West.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, actually, let me just hop in and say you've hit on one of my questions. It seems like this was a clue to me too, that the origin of the creature seemed to change. It wasn't, not only was he started off in an imaginary place, but the story behind where it came from kept being a different tale depending on who Hansen was talking to. Can you talk about that?
That's correct. Yeah. It originally started out as a block of ice floating off of the coast of Asia. He never was particularly clear about that. And then it changed to coming from the wilds of Minnesota. At one point, Hansen said he shot the creature in the wilds of Minnesota himself. Another time, a story was floated out that the creature was shot by a woman who was about to be raped by this wild ape man. And so this is classic BS by a showman. And this is again something that when I was on the sideshow, I was a performer, and my whole take on the sideshow was my goal was to try to come up with new stunts, right? Because when I entered a sideshow, I really did not have an understanding of the history of sideshow, and so I started out from square zero and started coming up with stunts on my own, right? Whereas Jim Rose was coming from this from a totally different aspect as a promoter. And so even though it was only about 3 years, it was practically like spending 24 hours a day with a guy and watching his every move and seeing how a promoter like Jim Rose operates. And you get these guys who generate a steady stream of stories, and it's like once they get on a roll, they just sort of can't stop. And so when I saw these stories that Frank Hansen was putting out, of course, I immediately think of Jim Rose, and it's like, well, of course, that's how sideshow showmen function. They and it's almost impossible for a guy like me to do that. I'm not a natural liar. I'm not a natural BSer. I'm not a natural storyteller. But there are people who are, and Hansen was clearly one of those. And so Hansen, in my opinion, Hansen is giving out all these just obvious clues to anybody who's hip to sideshow. You know, he's calling it the cyberskoy creature. He's changing his story. And yet all this time, you've got Sanderson and Heuvelmans are simply ignoring these clues. And as I'm trying to say, it's my belief that Sanderson and Heuvelmans came from this academic background, and the culture that they were raised with is totally different from the culture that a Frank Hansen comes from, the sideshow culture. There is a meeting of different worlds there. And I'm sorry to be blunt, but in my opinion, Sanderson and Heuvelmans were just clueless as to what was really going on.
And were all of the stories coming from Hansen, or were they originating elsewhere or from other people?
No, it was all from Hansen. I mean, and that's the problem. It's because soon enough, after the late 60s, some of the Bigfoot proponents were beginning to suggest, well, this is Bigfoot, right? Even though Heuvelmann said it was Homo pongloides, some of these Bigfoot proponents said, well, it's probably a subspecies of Bigfoot. And for many years, Lauren Coleman was the most widely known advocate that this was some kind of genuine hominoid or Bigfoot-type creature. For years, promoted that.
Does he still believe that? Do you know what the latest is on that?
No. And there's a story that goes with that. And it's this is the story with that. In 2008, we had two guys, Dyer and Whitten, from Georgia, who started saying, well, I've got a Bigfoot in a freezer, right? And they were putting out these YouTube videos. And one of these guys, I think it was one of the guys, actually was a police officer, right? But he was saying, oh, yeah, I've got Bigfoot. And this went on for several weeks. And even when they were releasing these videos, their story was becoming his story was beginning to fall apart, because in one of these videos, he introduces a fellow and said, well, here's this PhD scientist. And the PhD scientist says, well, yeah, we're going to take a look and see if this is the missing link. Well, no PhD scientist says a ridiculous term like the missing link. That's, I mean, it's your clear tip off that it's a fake. So everybody following the story, even from the beginning, knew that this guy's a fake. And then another gentleman on the internet did some background checking and realized that this PhD was actually a relative of Whitten and Dwyer's. And of course, eventually Tom Biscardi becomes involved, and it leads to a gigantic nationally broadcast press conference. Well, guess who was watching this press conference, but none other than Vern Langdon. And Vern Langdon was a man who had worked at Dawn Post Studios for a number of years. In fact, he had worked with the production of the Planet of the Apes films, and a very well-respected creature costume designer. Vern Langdon started posting on Bigfoot forums and saying, this is hilarious, because this is a redo of the Minnesota Iceman. And people started realizing that, well, this is the real deal. This is the real Vern Langdon. And they started realizing, wow, this is pretty amazing. And so, to their credit, the two guys running Bigfoot forums invited Vern Langdon onto their internet podcast. And so by August of 2008, Vern Langdon did an hour and a half interview with Brown and Vella regarding the backstory of the Minnesota Iceman. And at that point, it was just in my opinion, Langdon just killed the legend dead, because what he did is he explained the timeline that Frank Hansen had approached Don Post Studios as early as, I think, 1966, and said, "Well, I want this gaff, right? I'm going to start exhibiting a gaff for my touring exhibit, and I want you guys to build it." And according to Langdon, Langdon really didn't want to have anything to do with Hansen, because Langdon was on a professional level that was far above the kind of sleazy level that Hansen was on. And they said, "Well, we're not going to do it. We're going to refer you to another man named Howard Ball." And that appears to be the solution to the mystery of the Iceman, that it was it was fabricated by a gentleman named Howard Ball. There appears to be a little bit of a discrepancy in the accounts that I've got. One, Langdon says it was created out of, quote, hot melt, which is a vinyl. And others, relatives of Ball's, said, well, it was created out of rubber. According to Langdon, latex rubber is unstable in water. And I don't know enough about the polymers and whatnot to give you an answer what it ultimately was, but it was a rubbery polymer that was fabricated by Howard Ball and then, quote, ventilated, which the hairs were added by a different artist. And so the story becomes essentially untenable as a real animal, because it pushes the timeline back so far before 67. And then there was a blog entry on Cryptomundo in September by Lauren Coleman, in which she saw the light and said, well, I can no longer support the Minnesota Iceman. Coleman gives no mention to Vern Langdon's interview, but skeptics for many years were poking holes at the notion that the Minnesota Iceman was a real deal. And I'd like to draw your attention to an essay that was written. There was, before the internet, of course, there were fanzines, and there was a fanzine written by a gentleman named Chris Fellner. His fanzine was called Freaks. It ran from 1996 to 1998. And in February of 97, Fellner wrote a long article entitled The Mysterious Creature in Ice, which I have taken the liberty of uploading to my own website, in which he just really takes Sanderson and Heuvelmans to task for buying into this gaff as a real animal. I'll just read directly from what Fellner is saying. I mean, and Fellner's tone is a little bit vicious, but it really does encapsulate the tone of from a sideshow perspective. And Fellner writes, "It doesn't take a genius to poke holes in Sanderson's argument for Bozo's authenticity." They called him Bozo. First, he says, you cannot just make a corpse like this, either out of bits and pieces of the bodies of other animals or of wax, with some 500,000 hairs inserted into it, unquote. Why not? Didn't he ever hear of the Fiji mermaid, half fish and half monkey? As for inserting hairs into wax, maybe Sanderson should have visited the Ripley's Believe It or Not museums, where he would have found two life-size wooden statues of the Japanese artist Hanu Numa Masakichi. Masakichi-san created the perfect likeness of himself when he thought he was going to die from tuberculosis. He plucked every hair out of his body, including pubic hair, and painstakingly inserted them into tiny holes drilled into the statue's solid wood. Compared with that feat, putting hairs into wax would be a piece of cake.
Wow. We'll put a link to that article in the show notes on your website.
All right. Now, it's an excellent article from a sideshow perspective.
So Frank Hansen, he had some history of working with hoaxes, carnival sideshows, that sort of thing?
Yes. In fact, prior to the Cyber Squash creature, his primary exhibit was a John Deere tractor.
Real or a gaff?
No, it was awesome. Real. It was real. And there's
where do you even find one of those?
It was indeed a rare tractor. And there's the the premier historian of Sideshow is a guy named A.W. Stencil, and he's got two books out, excellent books on Sideshow history. One is entitled Seeing is Believing, and the other is a recent one entitled Circus and Carnival Ballyhoo. And he actually, Stencil found a photograph of Hansen's tractor. And so so the answer is yes, but obviously a tractor is a markedly different exhibit than a ape man.
And the Iceman is the true missing link, isn't he?
Well, they were bantying that term around. There were both Sanderson and Heuvelmans did indeed write these long technical write-ups, throwing in as much polysyllabic anatomical terminology as they could to clearly demonstrate to their scientific acumen. And this has been the fundamental cornerstone of all of the advocates over the years. Because there were no somatic samples ever taken of this exhibit, not a one, Hansen never allowed it to be thawed out and physically examined or tissue samples taken. Okay, so the Bigfoot advocates who say that this was a real creature, they all fall back on the argument from authority by saying that, well, Hansen and Heuvelmans were zoological experts, and they knew what they were talking about. They could tell the difference between a fabricated illusion and the real thing. And you may or may not, and that's of course, that's on the surface, that sounds like a great argument, but you may or may not know that Ivan Sanderson, as time went on, began to advocate more and more outrageous and untenable things. Speaking of things, he wrote two books. One was called Things, and another was called More Things. And the book More Things, published in 1969, he gives a long account of an event that occurred in 1948, in which a series of very large three-toed tracks were found in Clearwater, Florida. And Sanderson investigated these to a great extent. And this sounds like I'm making this up, this sounds like I'm kidding, but I'm not, that Sanderson eventually concluded that these were made by a 15-foot penguin. And on page 55 of the book, More Things, he writes, "A thick-billed penguin, 15 feet long, on the coast of Florida is admittedly pretty horrid, but I don't think we can legitimately any longer laugh it out of court." And years later, they found the man who actually engaged in the hoax, a guy named Tony Signorini. And Signorini had fabricated a set of large three-toed prosthetics out of cast iron. And there's also a link on my website to that, the 15-foot penguin episode. So for a long time, Sanderson was a somewhat credulous individual, and I think the most stunning example of the credulity of Ivan Sanderson is found on pages 74 and 75 of his book, More Things, because he's commenting on the nature of illusion with regards to the Patterson film. And he alludes to the movie The Lost World. Well, this guy who did the special effects for The Lost World was a guy named Willis O'Brien, who later on did the special effects for King Kong. And if you remember the movie, the original King Kong, King Kong is made to move in a kind of a herky-jerky way, and that's called stop motion. And that's how they did the special. That's how he did the special effects on The Lost World as well. They would take a model. They would move it a little bit, take a photograph or two, move the model a little bit, take a photograph or two, on and on and on. Very painstaking, tedious work. And that's why you get that kind of herky-jerky effect. But Ivan Sanderson had a different take on how those special effects were accomplished. And I quote from you from More Things, pages 74 and 75. Sanderson writes, "Even in the late 1920s, the dinosaurs in the film of Conan Doyle's The Lost World were utterly realistic close-ups of their heads showing drooling saliva, nictitating membranes, and flashing eyes. Incidentally, these dinosaurs were wearing skillfully constructed suits by a man who had a degree in paleontology and were fitted over live chickens. So Sanderson believed that live chickens with little dinosaur suits were what the special effects were made of from The Lost World. So Sanderson was, shall we say, a credulous individual.
Was he known to be a cryptozoologist before the Iceman appeared?
Oh yes. Yeah, he was. He had appeared on the Tonight Show. In a very sort of traditional role, but as time went on, he gravitated to the more and more unusual. But even today, Ivan Sanderson is held up to be this founding cryptozoologist, and in his advocacy of 15-foot penguins and chickens and dinosaur suits is conveniently written out of the history of this eminent cryptozoologist.
Well, let me ask you that now. Presumably, the Minnesota Iceman was not the first alleged, you know, either Bigfoot-like creature or humanoid creature encased in ice, right? Or was it the first that you know of?
Yes, it was. There was a frozen exhibit, and Vern Langdon went into this extensively in his podcast interview. There was a whale called Little Irvy, which was a real whale. And it really was encased in a block of ice. And it had been exhibited prior to Hansen. And so there are some who speculate that Hansen saw the success of Little Irvy and decided to emulate it. And I will say this. There's an important follow-up that should be noted. There are a lot of these advocates who still believe in the reality of the Minnesota Iceman, who say, well, I saw this thing, and it's real. And then they'll give various descriptions of it. And I have suspected this for a long time, and I finally got proof in Stenzel's books that, as of course, you often see in the entertainment business, as soon as something is successful, imitators come along. And that's what happened with the Minnesota Iceman. As soon as Hansen came out with the Cyberskoy creature, the Minnesota Iceman, other showmen began to copy his exhibit. And so I believe that Hansen's Iceman was the first of its kind, but there were certainly imitators that came after it. And so you have to take anybody who says, oh, I saw the Minnesota Iceman, and yada, yada, yada. Well, did you see Frank Hansen's, or did you see one of the imitators?
Which one did you see?
Right.
Right. In fact, just a quick follow-up. Well, I actually saw an updated version of the Minnesota Iceman 2 or 3 years ago at a state fair, and it was very similar to the descriptions and the drawings that you see, and it was presumably this sort of humanoid form, and the banners outside of the exhibit had this told this story of this Arctic explorer who had brought back this mysterious being encased in ice, and for mere $1.50 or whatever it was, you could go in and see it. So it's
right.
They're still touring in some versions.
Oh yeah. Well, to get into a deeper philosophical or artistic level about the Minnesota Iceman, it's been my experience. If you look at gaffes as art, right? If you look at them as sculpture, as fantasy sculpture, a lot of these artists have an almost irresistible impulse to incorporate some sort of grotesque or exaggerated or augmented feature, right? There's a fascinating book it's a very unusual book by a guy named Peter Dance entitled Animal Fakes and Frauds, and it details how far back in history gaffes go. And one of the earliest were mermaids. And in Dance's book, he alludes to mermaid exhibits that go back to like 1775. And reading here from Dance, It says, the reality is concocted by the mermaid manufacturer. Fell far short of the ideal of beauty because people would see claim to see mermaids and they were beautiful. And the ideal of beauty he's referring to. It is as if they knew that they could not produce anything even remotely as satisfying as the legendary mermaid and abandoned the attempt in favor of a grotesque parody of it. To achieve the parody, they had to resort to pastiche, as we shall now see. And so you see that, even from the very earliest days, the gaffes produced by these artists often ran to the grotesque, or at least they would incorporate a grotesque element. For instance, this gentleman that I'm quite, the artist that I'm quite fond of, William Bivens, you know, often will have these mouths open to reveal a mouth full of frightening teeth, right? Or in Higley's case, the shocking color of the skin. Higley's gaffes often run to the yellow and orange as far as skin color. I mean, so these artists often incorporate these particular augmentations. And in the Minnesota Iceman, you see this in the feet and the hands. And the British primatologist John Napier wrote a book entitled Bigfoot, the Yeti and Sasquatch in Myth and Reality. And he has an excellent account of the whole Minnesota Iceman. If you want an impartial account, that's an excellent version. And he alludes to this. And I love this word he uses. He uses the word spatulate, right? The hands were spatulate. And if you look at the photographs and the anatomical drawings, Ball, obviously, that was his signature. He made the hands and the feet almost cartoonishly big. It's like Beavis and Butthead. You know, they have cartoonishly big heads. And according to Vern Langdon, when Hansen approached Langdon, Hansen had a drawing with him. He says, well, I want you to produce this. So the idea probably originated with Hansen. And so I would say that from an artistic perspective, it's almost an irresistible urge on the part of these artists to augment something, to make it cartoonishly ridiculous, if you will. And, you know, so if you look at the hands alone should tell you that this is it's a ridiculous, non-human, non-biological entity.
Okay, so there's a really strange, it's strange enough that there's supposedly a frozen prehistoric man, but there's another aspect to this case that's always puzzled me. And that's, at some point, Hansen, for some reason, whether he was feeling too much pressure or heat because of the publicity or what, I don't know. He kind of disappears for a while and then comes back with what he calls a new Iceman.
Right.
And this new Iceman, according to, or if I'm reading it right, Sanderson, dismisses as an obvious hoax. But John Napier, who's another anthropologist who looked at both of them, says it's the same creature, just repositioned and refrozen. Did you get to see any photos of both to compare, or what was your take on that? Is it the same critter?
That's an excellent question. Yes. Well, the fact is that years ago I was debating online on Bigfoot forums this very issue. There was another gentleman who didn't have the sideshow background that I did, but still had enough of a knowledge of the anatomy and primatology and history of evolution. The guy who posts on Bigfoot forums under the handle of Wolf Tracks is a Bigfoot associate of mine, very intelligent guy, and he dug around to try to find these photographs because Lauren Coleman and an associate of Coleman's named Hall had taken some photographs, but none of them really had surfaced on the internet or whatnot. So this gentleman, Wolf Tracks, had done some comparisons, at least of the head of the quote original and the quote fake. I mean, in my belief, there was, of course, only one artifact, and that was this fabricated delusion. And I do believe that Napier's take is correct. It's my belief that there's no way that you could have kept this thing refrigerated constantly The energy requirements, the fuel required for a generator to keep this thing refrigerated constantly, literally for years, would have been impossible. And in fact, Joe Nickel wrote a book entitled Secrets of the Sideshows, and Nickel saw this exhibit, I believe in Canada, and it had melted out somewhat. And Nickel provides a first-person account of touching it. It says, it was lying in a freezer-like tank, but some of the ice had melted away, exposing part of the body. I reached in and felt it. Not surprisingly, it was rubbery, right? And so, yes, I believe that it definitely had melted out at some point. It got moved. And as far as the photographs, the only photographs that I've ever seen are of the head. And in my opinion, there are no differences between the head of the supposed original and the head of the supposed duplicate. And the real concession I found online, when Lauren Coleman wrote his blog entry on Cryptomundo on September 10, 2008, where he says, "Oh, I give up. I don't believe in it anymore." He was asked specifically by a Bigfoot advocate, "Lauren, could you please tell us the list of the 15 differences, which were a list that Sanderson and Heuvelmans created, a list of the alleged differences between the alleged original and alleged fake. I read there were differences, but not what they were." Lauren Coleman responds, "The list of 15 differences was formulated by Sanderson and Heuvelmans and never shared publicly or with Mark Hall and me. This was done so Sanderson and Heuvelmans could privately tell if the real body was ever shown again by Hansen, without Hansen or the secret owner knowing what these discovered differences were. The list may be hidden in the archive of Heuvelmans' files held in the Zoology Museum in Switzerland."
Wow.
Which is of course, you know, ridiculous, but becoming dead serious here for a minute, it's kind of like you submitted a paper to Nature and you said, "Well, I've made measurements of 15 parameters to a statistically significant difference of p less than 0.05%. And then the editor of Nature says, "Well, what are these parameters you've measured?" And you say, "Well, they're secret. They're secret." Well, you know, you would be treated like one of the angle trisectors submitting a proof of angle trisection to a mathematics journal. You know, the level of pseudoscience with keeping your secret criteria is absurd. I mean, that's pure unadulterated pseudoscience.
Or the second Iceman was on double secret probation.
Double secret probation. Yeah. Well, I will straight up tell you this. I mean, I don't know exactly how it works, but I will tell you that it works. In that, to promote stuff like sideshow stuff, you kind of need to keep up a continuous stream of BS to keep the customer interested, or else the story just loses it peters out and loses interest. You know, I saw Jim Rose do this. I mean, Jim Rose was on a roll, you know, 24 hours a day, hyping the show and telling different stories with little twists here, there, and everywhere. And in my opinion, it was a perfect story for Frank Hansen to tell, just to simply keep the publicity machine alive and deepen the mystery and keep people curious. You know, it's just pure hype. And Sanderson, Heuvelmans, and for a while Lauren Coleman believed this hype.
So let me ask, I mean, is that why the Iceman became so famous and why it's still talked about today, is because of Sanderson and others, or was it just great showmanship by Hansen, or a combination, or what do you attribute the fact that we're still talking about this?
Well, I think we're seeing the twilight. I think that 2008 was the real watershed, because Lauren Coleman really was the last of the major advocates as far as within the Bigfoot world. I know that outside of the Bigfoot world, there's this other gentleman named Lloyd Pye. And if you go to Lloyd Pye's website, Lloyd Pye is more known for an anomalous skull that he possesses called a Starchild skull, in which he claims it was a product of human-alien hybridization. But Pye also claims to be a hominoid or hominid researcher. And this is very interesting because I've looked on his website, and he produces an illustration of the Minnesota Iceman, and caption reads, "The second best proof of hominoid reality is this creature shot through the mid-back, note exit hole in the chest, and finished off through the left eye socket, rear of the head is blown away. Its corpse was frozen in a block of ice and displayed from 1968 to 1980 at fairs and malls in the United States and Canada. It made its owner rich at the expense of what could have been learned from careful scientific analysis of it. I saw it as a young man and have no doubt on a personal level that it was absolutely real and not faked in any way." And this is a very interesting claim by Lloyd Pye, because no one besides Lloyd Pye has ever noted the presence of a, quote, gunshot wound, especially an exit gunshot wound, in the chest of this creature. And there's only a couple of possibilities. Either Pye saw a different exhibit than Hansen exhibited, or Lloyd Pye is grossly mistaken, or Lloyd Pye was able to, with Superman vision, see something that nobody else saw. So I'm going to go with Occam's razor here and say that Lloyd Pye is simply mistaken, that there was never any gaping exit wound hole in Frank Hansen's exhibit. But I will say that Lloyd Pye is in the minority. You know, he was never really incorporated in the subculture of Bigfootery. Mm-hmm. If you look at Jeff Meldrum's book, or Chris Murphy has got a new book out on Bigfoot, you will not see the Minnesota Iceman listed in the index. And it's my belief that, believe it or not, this is one of those subjects that's kind of gone by the wayside as far as Bigfooters claiming, well, this is the Bigfoot that got away.
You've actually raised an issue I had, which was that maybe he's doing the same thing with this creature in a block of ice, which is hard to see, becomes kind of like a Rorschach test in the same way Patty is, that you can kind of see the details you want to see if you try to squeeze them out of there.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And in fact, I think that's part of the genius of Frank Hansen, in that it was up to him to determine how much ice and of what lucidity to place over the exhibit. How much do you want to expose of it? You know, how dirty do you want to make the window that you have to look through to see this exhibit? That was some real genius on Hansen's part. It's a tease. You know, you show just enough.
I've read that Hansen was making 35 cents or 25 cents per view of the Iceman. Do you have any idea of how much he made on this exhibit?
I think he made thousands and thousands of dollars. According to Vern Langdon, he estimated that the fabrication by Ball of the exhibit would have cost about $5,000. And then he had to go to, I believe it was Union Ice, to get the refrigerator custom made, right? So that would have been thousands of dollars as well. But he probably did make his profits back over time. I don't have any idea what the numbers were, but just by the sheer number of people going through on a daily basis, it was quite a successful exhibit.
Mm-hmm. Ironically, as this Iceman, you know, is closely tied, at least from a timeline, to Bigfoot and the Patterson-Gimlin film. And I noticed when I was doing some research for the show that Patterson's brother-in-law, Aldy Attlee, blames the Iceman for their loss of about $100,000 in investment. So,
A competition, yes.
I guess the something happened like in the Rochester Post Bulletin. Hansen somewhat, I guess, kind of sideways admitted to a hoax. And it, according to the Attlee, that really killed the market for Bigfoot after they had already prepaid for, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars for, theater rental and advertising and other things. But there's so many weird stories involved with the Patterson-Gimlin. And you know, when you have people hawking a possibly hoaxed Bigfoot film competing with possibly hoaxed Iceman, it is the truth is the last thing you'll see, I imagine. So,
yeah, that's a very good point. That's a very good point. One thing that my former Sideshow associate, Tim Cridland, who goes by the stage name Zamora, who's probably the world's greatest human pincushion act today, and an excellent historian on Sideshow, one thing that he suggested to me, and this is an excellent point, is that you've got to realize that, and indeed you are correct, that Hansen at one point said, well, what this is a fabricated illusion. This is a fabricated illusion, right? And Tim Cridland has suggested to me that, well, you've got a problem, especially when you cross a border. And there was an incident where Hansen is trying to transport his exhibit across national boundaries into Canada. Well, what if you are traveling with an exhibit and a genuine scientist like Heuvelmans calls it Homo, the same genus as man? Well, suppose you have some overzealous customs official or local sheriff or police officer or something that decides that, well, maybe we've got a hippie on our hands, you know, this is a human. This is just a hairy human, because there are hairy humans. There are people who suffer from hypertrichosis and whatnot. So what if, for whatever reason, someone at customs decides to seize the exhibit? Well, Hansen therefore creates for himself an out. If he publicly says, well, this is a fabricated illusion, then he can use that argument at a border or with some sort of official who might want to confiscate the thing.
I think the thing that I find most interesting about the Minnesota Iceman story is just that it is, at least for a while, it was taken very, very seriously among cryptozoologists. And here it is, to our modern, admittedly skeptical eye, it's a fairly self-evident hoax, especially if you know anything about the carnival and sideshows and everything else. But, you know, as with the 15-foot tall penguins, I think it's a very instructive case in cryptozoology, and in fact, in the paranormal in general, of where, you know, an actual legitimate hoax fooled the experts. And there you go.
Yes, it is. It's taken a long, long time. It's something that Michael Dennett told me, which I didn't believe at first, but I've come to see what he told me is the truth. And I don't think this idea was unique to Dennett. I think it was been known long before Dennett came around. But, you know, Mike Dennett said that evidence never goes away, but there's always somebody out there. No matter how well something is debunked, it's always going to stick around. And if you look over the UFO field, you still have guys promoting a UFO crashed in Roswell, or you still have guys promoting the MJ-12 documents. And, you know, you can find examples of this everywhere. I mean, the whole notion of creationism. There are creationists out there who will not deny, this Earth is 6,000 years old. I mean, these are just ridiculous concepts, and yet there are people who ardently believe them. So I think guys like Lloyd Pye will forever hang on to this notion, even though it's ridiculous.
And, Matt, we always ask our guests to name their favorite monster. So what's your favorite monster?
Oh, Sasquatch, of course.
That one. Which one is that?
The one we always talk about.
He goes by many names. Northern California, he's known as Bigfoot. To the Hoopa Indians, he's known as Omaha, or, you know, Boss of the Woods. But in terms of fiction, of course, in terms of known fiction, it would, of course, be Gorn from the episode Arena.
That's a classic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you see the Mythbusters where they tried to reproduce the canon?
I did. I had mixed feelings about it, like I have mixed feelings about Mythbusters, right. But they didn't add the, you know, and that I confess that I indeed made gunpowder myself when I was 10 years old. Back in the day, in the early 70s, you could actually buy potassium nitrate from pharmacies. You could actually buy sulfur from pharmacies, and of course you'd get your charcoal briquettes. And I made gunpowder like Captain Kirk did back when I was 10 years old.
We'll edit this out.
No.
But I never contained it. Unlike Captain Kirk, I never contained it. I just let it. And I think, you know, I've got 2 eyes and 10 fingers and 10 toes. And
yeah, you and I have that in common. We've messed with things that probably should never have done. Right? I'm still surprised that I'm not a big piece of scar tissue.
Yeah. Right? Well, I will publicly confess that I made my last IED when I was 18.
There you go, right.
Yeah, and that is the truth.
Good of you to clarify, Matt.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much for spending some time with us talking about the Minnesota Iceman, Matt.
Thank you, Matt.
We'll put a link to your website in our show notes.
Monster Talk.
You just listened to an interview with Matt Crowley about the strange story of the Minnesota Iceman. One correction, the Scooby-Doo episode featuring the Iceman is in Season 2, titled Scooby's Night with a Frozen Fright. Monster Talk is hosted by myself, Blake Smith, Dr. Karen Stolzner, and Benjamin Radford. Monster Talk is produced with the help of Skeptic Magazine. If you like skepticism and investigating mysteries, you should be reading Skeptic Magazine and Skeptical Inquirer. Seriously. Monster Talk theme songs by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Intro music was by Robin, both used by permission. The opinions expressed on Monster Talk are not necessarily those of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society, but we're glad they help us put on the show.
Want to stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.